So I'd like to just begin by thanking Tweri for her months of teaching, and I'm taking over the baton of teaching for the next 2 months, rounding out the year. And we're continuing with this exploration of dependent origination, and it's a very pertinent topic, especially in this day and age. I just want to acknowledge just the difficulty that the election tomorrow may bring. You know, at Sims, we try to keep Sims very much politically neutral, so we don't make any assumptions about what side of the political spectrum we might be. And yet what gets elicited is very great grounds for Dharma practice. It's a great way to explore practice and see how we take shape, how we take form, how we birth ourselves into these intense states. So I know emotions are running high. There's much anxiety. There's worry. There's a sense of a lot being at stake, regardless of which side you find yourself on the political spectrum. And I'm lucky enough to have conversations with both sides, so I can, you know, get a sense of really the how intense and how strong both sides may feel. I was reflecting on what would be helpful on this day before our presidential election. Would be of most service. You know, and first of all, it's just that sense of connection, of grounding, of finding your place on the earth, bringing your attention away from the mind storm and noticing how actually are my feet touching the ground? How actually is the breath moving through my body? What sensations are present right in this moment? This provides this place of stability and centeredness, which can be so helpful and so beneficial when our minds are churning, our minds are upset and worried. And once that is established to some degree, we have some connection with the ground, then turning toward it with wisdom, turning toward with wisdom to understand the nature of how our suffering is being created in this moment. And so tonight I'd like to weave these two together, how to see that sense of suffering in the context of dependent origination, particularly of birth. Because this really is a golden opportunity to explore this link. And, you know, often in a very intense time for us to see how our practice can really come forth and support us. And no matter what side you might be on, if you are on a side, the sense of self is activated right now. The sense of self is engaged through its hopes, its fears, the sense of I am being right and they are wrong. It doesn't matter who you might want to win the election. This is arising for all of us. Of course, there's very real things to be concerned about, not to discount that. There's so many unknowns and uncertainty, again, no matter what side you might be on. But what is the essential Dharma question? What is the question of practice? What is the question of liberation? This is really what Sims is about, is understand what is that question that allows us to turn toward this moment, even with its difficulty, and see the pathway to liberation. So going into this sense of the birth, this next link, you know, how that's created. Now birth, you know, we're being moment by moment birthed into a new sense of self, a new sense of who we take ourselves to be. The sense of I, the sense of me, of mine. You know, no matter, tomorrow is our presidential election, and no matter who you may hope wins, you're creating a sense of self around it. You're creating a sense of self around it. And we're taking birth again and again. The question that we're going to hold for this month is how do we see that sense of self? Whether it's around something like the election or some other difficulty or something that's immensely pleasurable and interesting to you, how that sense of self arises. So initially that word of birth, you know, becoming, you know, we might think, well, what's wrong with that? You know, what's wrong? Because as a culture, we like new beginnings. We like taking form, the new romance, the first day of school, the new job, the new child, the new grandchild, a new exciting hobby, even a new meditative state or technique that we really find interests us, that brings a sense of fulfillment. We like the new stuff. We like that. We like to orient to new states of being. But these births, if we step back, are constantly going on. There's a repetitiveness to it. The same reactions, the same patterns, again and again. The same things bring us enjoyment, bring us a pleasure. But they're not lasting. They're impermanent. They're subject to change. And then, of course, there's the unpleasant states of being, the states, unpleasant, painful, distressing, horrible states of being that we take birth into. The worry, the fear, the sadness, the anger. These two are births. These two are part of the cycle of dependent origination. We can't choose to just have pleasant births. Even if we could, because they're impermanent, we'll feel that sense of sorrow when they pass, when they end. And there's also repetitiveness. The same things continue to bring us pain, continue to create that sense of reactivity in our hearts, in our minds. So what to do? What to do as the Dharma practitioner? And of course, the next link in the chain of dependent origination is death and decay. And birth is always going to be followed by death, period. Birth will always be followed by death, which then leads into a state of grief, of suffering, of lamentation. This re-triggers the quality of ignorance and starts the cycle again. This is really the big issue. This is the big issue that we face as Dharma practitioners, is that when there is a birth, it's going to lead to death. Now, death, whether it's of this physical body or the death of this mind state, this death of this state of mind, this state of identity, this birth, where there's death, when there's birth, there's death. And when there's death, there will be suffering. And when there's suffering, it can lead and re-trigger that quality of ignorance. So how we relate to this momentary birth of self predisposes us to create more suffering or to create more selfing. Selfing, creating the sense of I, the sense of me. Unless we bring our practice to bear. Unless we bring our practice to bear. This is the essential point of the Buddha's teaching, that there is a way through this cycle of suffering, to seeing this process, understanding it, and becoming free of it. He said, I would not teach this. I would not ask you to do it if it was not possible. So the mission or the quest we have is to understand how our reactivity, how our ignorance creates this sense of a solid self. This is dukkha. This is what we mean by the Four Noble Truths. So birth is a part of the cycle of dependent origination. The classical image of this is a woman giving birth. And it's been preceded by a pregnancy, like as we do in humans, by the first 10 links. But these last 10 months of expiration that Tuari and myself have offered have described a process that takes microseconds. It takes microseconds. So much of this is so preloaded in our system. Our past history, our reactivity is preloaded. It's like a precariously balanced log that just resting there and just needs a little push to send it tumbling. Just a little impulse, and suddenly we're going into this pattern of clinging, of craving, into becoming, into birthing. You see a political commercial, you hear something that distresses you, and you find yourself spinning suddenly into worry, into reactivity, into anger, because it's preloaded in us. We find ourselves engaging in our senses, craving, clinging, wanting, not wanting, churning out this solid sense of self, creating something out of nothing into something that seems solid, becoming into birth, and then into old age and death, and then back to ignorance. So this process of selfing continues to fuel our ignorance, continues to fuel the background ignorance that gets this whole cycle going. It strengthens and maintains our ignorance, and in that way maintains our suffering. And there's a powerful momentum to this. that keeps the cycle going. And really, each person needs to see the limitation of birth for ourselves. Because again, there's such an allure to it. There's a tremendous amount of delusion that drives it, that makes us move through it. There's this tremendous hunger to be or not to be, the tanha that Tuareg talked about in a month or so ago. And the seeing that limitation, sometimes we're motivated by the depth of our suffering. It continues and we just want to find another way of relating to this mind. This is what motivated the Buddha, seeing the four heavenly messengers of sickness, of old age, and of death, to find where is their happiness even with this reality. Others are really motivated by the mystery, by the wonder, the sense of interconnection, that when that sense of self falls away, that draws us into that. But that takes a path that each one of us have to take, you know, to understand the birth, the sense of birth, and how we maintain that birth. This is really the question of how to create suffering and maintain that suffering. This is the whole question of Dharma practice, because we don't have control of what birth we take. Some are enjoyable, or like heaven on earth. Others are horrible, like hell on earth. We know this. We know this. We can go through life and suddenly we get that call, we get that email, and we're suddenly walking on cloud nine. And then the next day, a different email or call comes in, or a different text, and we're in a place of a hell realm in our mind's worry. And both are impermanent. Both are impermanent. So how do we interrupt this? How do we transform it? This is the question that we focus on this month. So tonight we want to see how this birth, the sense of birthing, creates and maintains our suffering. Or how can we move to its release? How can in this moment of birth, even the very painful mind state that may be elicited by this coming election, that too can be an opportunity to start to release in a very deep way the sense of self and this momentum that carries again and again. And I'm going to explore this interplay between what we can call the relative and absolute realities. This is a common teaching of the relative reality and the absolute reality, how these interplay together and work together, and what this teaches us about a relationship to self. And when things happen to us that are bad in a very personal way, in a very personal level, things like cancer, things like divorce, like the loss of a loved one, the loss of a job, the loss of a possession, you know, including things like who isn't elected president, we don't give up our practice. That's actually the best time to bring our practice to bear. When those worldly winds shake us to the core, is how do we practice? I believe is either Ajahn Buddhadasa or Ajahn Chah practicing in Asia. And the communist had, there's this risk of the communists coming, you know, back in the 70s or 60s. And the practitioner is so worried about what would happen. And he said, we can still practice, even if the communists come. We can still practice. You know, even if the tornado comes, the earthquake comes, even if that dreaded diagnosis comes, we can still practice. And that's the confidence that we start to develop as we meet these difficulties of life. We start to see how practice can be this true refuge, as it brings a place of not only stability, but actually a place of wisdom. Even the difficulty can bring a source of deep happiness, a deep ease. Because the Buddha didn't teach a path that only worked when things are going well. It wasn't like, okay, if things are going well, then you can practice. In fact, his practice depended upon and was really motivated by the four messengers that he sought him, that he saw and sought his practice to find a release through, a path through. In these times, I think, as many of us have discovered, The practice still works, and we may actually find it's the only thing that works. So here's a fundamental issue, that we tend to focus on the circumstances of our life, the situation that we find ourselves in. And we are so busy reacting to that, trying to manage it, trying to navigate that, that we just take the sense of me, the sense of self, the sense of I at face value. It's just this assumption that I have to arise to navigate this, to meet this, to react to it. And we believe that our reactivity, our suffering, is because of the circumstances. And actually, it is because of the selfing around it. This is a bit of a radical statement, that the circumstances are less important to our suffering than our attitude toward it. Our attitude toward life has more to do, our relationship to that experience, it's more to do with our suffering than the actual circumstance itself. These particular circumstances and situations are less important than how we are relating to them from a dharmic perspective. What the weather is, what the emotion is, what the thought is, the specific content matters much less than how we are relating to it. Sitting in a quiet hall, a noisy hall, a painful body, a comfortable body, both are ultimately fine. Who is in the White House is less important, dharmically, than how we relate to that. So even pointing toward really the path of liberation, the path of freedom that's outside of the circumstances, the situations. Now, before you rush to protest and argue that, let's explain this and explore this a bit more using the framework of the absolute versus relative realities. Because this concept is very helpful to start to loosen the grip of selfing, of creating this sense of me. And it works by directing us to the absolute reality that holds a relative. This is really the key thing, that the absolute holds a relative, but the relative does not hold the absolute. So what is the relative? What do I mean by the relative? This is the truth, the reality that is relative to us, to our experience, whether it's us as an individual, the us of the like-minded people, the political party we subscribe to, whatever us that we could strive, there's a sense of what is relatively true. These are all the forms, the details of our lives. And what's relatively true for me isn't necessarily relatively true for you. You know, you just have to spend a few minutes looking at the divisiveness in our country to see this. Both sides are convinced of their relative truth. They're convinced of it. Just as we are convinced of our truth, they are convinced of their truth. Where, however that they and me lines up. And this relative plane is the only plane that we can argue on. We have to have that sense of division, that sense of otherness, that sense of relativeness to create that sense of argument. We can only talk about the spiritual. We can talk about the spiritual and argue about it from the relative perspective. I mean, think of all the religious wars, always related back to this relative. We think that our truth is absolute, but it's just our relative reality interpreting it. The same exact thing with political beliefs and convictions. Anytime that we're operating with thoughts, with concepts and beliefs, we're operating from this sense of the relative. Anytime that we're operating from the sense of self, we're also operating from the sense of the relative. Now, the relative, of course, we deeply care about. We deeply care about their relative realities. You know, it deeply affects our life, our well-being, and how we are in the world, and our loved ones. And we should care. We should care. We, as humans, we vote as one expression of that relative reality. And they affect our lives profoundly. It's just important to realize that your relative reality isn't the absolute reality. that what helps you may not help or may actually harm another person. So it's not about, this discussion is not about stopping us from caring about having investment in our relative realities. It's about giving us a broader perspective, a perspective that holds all relative realities. This is the path toward liberation. So what is the absolute? What is the absolute reality? The key element of this is a sense of self. The sense of me is not forefront. It's not running the show. It's seen through as an illusion. You see the sense of one way to describe it is that profound sense of interconnection, the lack of essential difference between all things, or how all things are essentially united. And the world is experienced through that perspective. And there's no solid sense of self to land on. There's no solid sense of self to relate everything back to and to project outward into the sense of other. It just doesn't make sense to do that from this absolute perspective. Thoughts, concepts, ideas don't have a place to land. As I spoke about earlier this year, that sense of the lake, and if you threw a pebble, how you expect the splash to happen. And the absolute, that reaction doesn't happen. It just passes right through. Now we need both. We need both the relative and absolute realities. And especially need the relative reality to function in this world. And we need the absolute to find a sense of freedom, regardless of situation, of circumstances, to liberate our hearts. So the rub is, though, that from the selfing perspective, from the perspective of dependent origination, from this closed loop, only the relative matters, or even only the relative exists. It's all cycling back to the relative reality, all centered around the sense of me, having this experience, me wanting, not wanting, of having this identity, having this opinion, of creating the sense of other that I'm fighting against, that I'm trying to overcome, or the other that I'm fearful of, that I'm running away from. So the relative perspective can't make sense of the absolute. And this is often the source of many of the paradoxical questions that come up. That, like, what about this situation? I'm hearing the teachings, but what about this real life situation of how do I deal with my children, with my aging parents, with my job, with my spouse, with my work? How do I deal with the environmental crisis? How do I deal with this political crisis? Again, however you might examine it or define it. Right? This is the relative in control. Again, not to discount the need for that, the place of the relative. But the problem is that we take it as being the only reality. Dharma practice is about waking up to another reality, the absolute reality. When we're in the relative reality, dependent origination is alive and running. This is the sense of self as an unexamined assumption of reality. The sense of self is an unexamined assumption of reality. And the relative becomes what we bounce off of, what triggers our sankharas, our name and form, our vedana, our craving, our clinging, our becoming, our birth, our death, our suffering. These are the particulars, the content of our life and the world. And so we react to those particulars to create the sense of self. This is the really nutshell version of dependent origination. The world has its sense data, and we react to it, and we create a sense of self. The way we create that sense of self guarantees we'll have suffering. So I encounter someone who's holding an opposite view, whether it's political or religious or just moral, whatever it might be. At first, it's just a sound that my ears perceive and hear. Then I start to make meaning of it. based on my past history, my past experiences. I start to like it or dislike it. Perhaps disliking brings a sense of tightness in the body, a sense of anger. And our whole life's conditioning around anger starts to come forth. This sense around anger, around injustice, morality may arise. And then before we know it, we realize, I am an angry person. And this is how I act in the world. We have taken birth. Okay? This is impermanent. It will pass. But in the midst of it, we can really suffer quite a bit from that. And then depending on how we relate to it, it can recreate the seeds for the next cycle of suffering. Now, the absolute reality holds these particulars without creating the sense of self. Okay, the sense of the absolute perspective, the absolute reality, holds the particulars of life, you know, the sounds, the thoughts, the emotions, the memories, without creating the sense of self. And this is the way that the absolute holds the relative. The absolute holds the relative. While the relative cannot hold the absolute, we might convince ourselves that it does, and we may pretend to speak from it. But it's just actually more distortion. So that if we take this even further, and this is where it starts to, the relative aspect of our minds, the relative conditioning starts to kind of get uneasy with some of this. That the absolute in its essence sees beyond the content of our lives. It's what holds all. So it doesn't matter what that content is. It doesn't matter if it's the bunny running through the woods or if it's the fox chasing the bunny and killing it. Both are held in a sense of equal balance. So this becomes, we start to touch into what's called the unconditioned, the deathless, what is outside the cycle of dependent origination. This is what the Buddha uncovered. This is the path. One of my favorite poems by Rumi that points to this, and I think it's such a lovely teaching poem that I've shared a number of times, that out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other doesn't make any sense. This is a beautiful description of the absolute reality. Out beyond this field of the relative, where our ideas, our concepts do matter in such a vital way, to go to some place outside of that, that field where I'll meet you, when the soul lies down in that grass, when we fully surrender to that, we fully open to that, the world is not empty and void. It's actually too full to talk about. It's too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other doesn't make any sense because there's no sense of separation. This is the absolute speaking through. So the trick as Dharma practitioners is learning to sense that, to discover that absolute, even in the midst of a painful reality, relative reality. So the election is a relative world issue. It's a relative reality issue. And most people are invested in it in one way or going one way or another. And Tuari and I and the local Dharma leaders, we try not to assume that everyone listening is of one mind, because we deeply believe the Dharma should be accessible to all people. So when we speak about it, we're using it as a way of entering into the Dharma, but not assuming that you agree with my state of mind or my beliefs around it. Because we need to learn to let go of that relative reality, that relative truth, for just a little bit at least. It's almost like suspending it, saying, okay, I'm going to set this aside. This is so vital to allow that absolute reality to start to reveal itself, to start to come forth, because it's so easily obscured and covered up by the intensity and the urgency of the relative reality. And again, if we stay within the relative reality, we're locked into a sense of self. The relative reality and the sense of self, we can say, are one and the same. So the Dharma question, I think, is so helpful, is, and that comes from the absolute, is how am I taking birth in this moment? How am I taking birth in this moment? So all the links that we've explored so far in dependent origination can happen in microseconds. And then we're suddenly in this state of birth, the sense of who I am. Anytime you voice an opinion, anytime you feel a reaction, anytime you have a self-defining thought, you're in a sense of self. Even when you're quietly meditating and you're observing and saying, wow, this is really peaceful. It's a much more subtle quality of self. Now, from the absolute perspective, it doesn't matter what birth is present in this moment. It doesn't matter what circumstances triggered it. The key point is how do we relate to it? How do we actually relate to this birth that either creates more suffering or leads to the end of that suffering? Now, usually we act in a way that creates more suffering. That's why practice is so difficult at times, because we have so much momentum going over and over again. So usually we act in a way that maintains it and guarantees it will arise in the future. When my daughter was very young, she loved to swing. So, you know, I'd go into the playground and push her, and she would just say, "More, Daddy, more." And I would do that for 20 minutes, for half an hour. She was insatiable for her appetite for swinging. And this, I'm going to use this as an analogy of how that swinging had that constant input of momentum, how to keeping that little bit of momentum. Otherwise, she would naturally swing down, especially before she learned how to pump her legs. So we get that momentum at one extreme and wants to swing back. And we can relate to it in a way that adds momentum, that keeps it going, or we can let it gently quiet down. You know, we have to put energy in the system. So what this looks like is our minds churning, ruminating, the papancha, that we think about one thought that's disturbing, we start to think more thoughts. Or going on the internet and surfing the web to find reading that supports our view, that supports our state of mind, the things that we get more upset about. This is the volitional action. This is the action of karma, defined by meaning action. Remembering back to the early segments, whenever we act in relationship to our experience, we're generating this volitional action. We're generating this potential that has to be expressed at some point. This is the habits of mind, to talk about it in a more modern way. You know, the more we fire a neurological path, it takes less stimulation for that to fire in the future. I remember when I was taking guitar lessons, and I would be playing a piece for my teacher, and I would make a mistake. And I would often, when I was practicing, make a mistake, and just over and over again, I would kind of jump over a hard measure or something. And he taught me that every time I made a mistake, I had to practice it 10 times correctly to undo that mistake, because the mind slips into that habit of mind. So we have this habit of selfing, this habit of reaction that we can easily slip into. So it takes a lot of diligence, a lot of sincerity, a lot of interest to turn toward this, to really meet it, to understand it. If we do, then we can start to relate to this birth in a way that loosens this momentum, that starts to loosen the sense of selfing and suffering. And a fundamental way to do this is something we've been practicing from day one, that we just need to apply it in a new area. Just how we become aware of our breath, of our body, and maybe get become aware of an emotion and start to realize, I am not my emotions. Remember when you first realized that a thought come up, and I can actually observe the thought. And realizing, because I'm observing it, that means I'm not that thought. Just that aha of realizing, there's actually something I can, there's a capacity that can observe something that seems so much of who I was, even simply with the body, to this assumption of this is my body, this is physically who I am. And we actually close our eyes and tune into it. It becomes this changing sea of sensation, this changing field of awareness. And that sense of me starts to dissolve. So then what we learn to do is to use that same process to identify what our mind state is. What's the mind? Is it a mind of worry? Because so often we're conditioned to look at the mind in a way that's trying to correct it, trying to fix it, trying to manage it. And unfortunately, as Dharma practitioners, we sometimes become very sophisticated in that, have a much more sophisticated idea of what is right and what is wrong in our minds. And so we have this observation skill, but then we judge more subtly what is being observed. So all we have to do is learn to step back and say, oh, this is what my mind is doing. This is what my mind is in this moment. My mind's reactive. My mind is really invested and upset about this. And to do that without adding a secondary judgment, you're starting to undo the conditioning. You're starting to unwind this momentum of the cycle of dependent origination. You're starting to lead, you're starting to step into the path of freedom from suffering. And then even stepping back a little further to notice that sense of me that's taken shape, that sense of me that's formed in relationship to that. Now, this may seem like it's very subtle or kind of hard to observe, and certainly the more subtle aspects can be. But the more obvious qualities, just that sense of, okay, I am a person who's upset right now. Let's say you're talking to someone who's on a different side of the political spectrum than you, and you're really invested. And you hear that person's words and you find yourself getting tighter and tighter. Usually we just keep spiraling down that to something shakes us out of that. In the middle of that, step back and say, oh, my mind is really worried. My mind is really agitated. My mind is really angry right now. So we have to step back a little bit from the content. If we stay focused on the content, we're just going to keep maintaining it. We're going to keep that cycle going. So there's the content. There's my reaction to it. Can I observe my reaction, the state of mind? It can be helpful to really name it somewhat precisely. Oh, my mind is really worried right now. Right? And then you step back even a little bit further to notice the sense of you who is worried. Even just say, oh, I'm taking birth into a worried person. And as you do that, you can start to see how the whole world has been kind of formulated around that sense of you. Right? It may sound a little subtle, but I think if you play with it, you can see how from that sense of being a worried person, you pay attention to stuff that makes you worried. To use a different example, let's say, you know, I know some of us are parents, some of us are grandparents, some of us, you know, have spouses, have husbands or wives, partners. However that relationship that you're really invested in, how that relationship gets activated when you're in front of that other person. And there's that, okay, I have to manage my teenage daughter to make sure she goes to bed on time and not on her cell phone too much. That's stepping into this role of the parent that can be very convincing, and there's all the actions and logic that flow from that. They can step back and feel that sense of, you know, maybe trying to control, trying to make sure she's doing the right thing, feeling that there's the controlling mind. And then stepping back and there's the controlling parent. And suddenly I may still need to act in a certain way, but I'm not believing it in the same way. I'm not completely lost in it. The sense of identification has loosened a little bit. We just need a little bit of a space in it to start to open the whole process up. There's a huge difference between no space, complete enmeshment in the sense of self, the sense of identity, and a little bit of space. And the same process that we learned how to meditate, to feel our breath, to feel an emotion, to see how it's something that arises and passes away, it's the same process we can bring to this sense of me that's arising and passing away. So you can play with it in some of those roles that you pick up, whether you have a job or you're retired or whatever your roles that you step into. And you can notice how that role you set aside. I'm no longer a parent when I'm going out and doing something else in the world. And then I pick that back up when it's appropriate. So you start to have this sense of fluidity. And now with the intensity of the election and what might be going through your mind, that too is also a sense of self. So learning to step back and seeing how that reaction is, really naming it, clearly seeing it. This is a clear acknowledgement of it. And do it with a sense of non-judgmentalness, a sense of almost compassion or kindness toward, almost bowing to it, like, oh, I'm really angry right now, for example, or I'm very fearful right now. And then getting a sense of that person who's fearful. And what is that like? That creates that little bit of space, that little bit of non-identification. It starts to loosen the enmeshment that ties us completely to the cycle of suffering, the cycle of dependent origination. Even if you find yourself looking at your mind and saying, oh no, I'm being angry. I shouldn't be angry because I'm a good Buddhist person. You realize, okay, I'm judging my judgment. I'm judging myself. Wherever you can step back and wherever you can catch it, wherever it can create a sense of space, that is enough. And just notice what arises from that. Notice the sense of space that may come in the midst of being very reactive, very angry. If you start to do that, you develop this confidence to meet whatever life brings because you're starting to relate to life from the absolute reality versus the enmeshment and the relative. All right. Thank you for your kind attention. And we'll sit for a few moments just so that those words settle. Thank you. In a few moments, we'll have a chance for any comments or questions you might have. But I want to first talk about the practice and reflection or the homework for this week. I'm going to put it in the chat with a little luck. Okay, good. It gets a little kind of condensed in this chat, but you can copy and paste it, and it should be up on the website too. So this week, bring your practice to charged mind states. So I'm giving you a little challenge here. Okay, when you find yourself being really worked up and anxious, angry, excited, whatever it might be, first ground yourself. Find a sense of centeredness, a sense of where is the earth right now in relationship to my body? Where's the feet touching the ground? Where's my body touching the chair or the cushion? This is a practice you can do wherever you are. It's not just the formal sitting practice. It's a practice of life, of moving through your world. Do this by connecting to the breath, to body sensations, particularly body sensations which bring a quality of calming. Because sometimes when we're angry, we can turn into that anger sensation and actually makes the anger a little more intense at first. So for the sense of grounding, find something that's more neutral or more cool. And then from this, once you have that sense of grounding, that gives you a little bit more of a finding your feet underneath you. Acknowledge what is the state of mind with as little judgment as possible. For example, oh, the mind is worrying. The mind is worrying. And then acknowledge the sense of self that is being created. So this is like, it may take a few minutes or a few hours to kind of work through this. So, okay, when you see that sense of that mind, okay, the mind is worrying. And then eventually start to ask, where's this sense of self? Can I acknowledge that sense of me who's being created? Just define it, just kind of lay it out there. Oh, I'm taking the shape of a worried person. I'm taking the shape of an angry person. without judgment, without trying to change what you're seeing. The only task is simply to see it clearly and acknowledge it. This is the power of direct seeing. See if this gentle stepping back from the enmeshment of the mind state creates some sense of spaciousness. This is really what we're doing, is trying to step back from that enmeshment to see with spaciousness. All right, so we have some chance for any comments or questions. And you're welcome to just unmute yourself. I think I gave you permission to do that. And I can dialogue with you. I know sometimes it's hard to go from the listening mode to the speaking mode. But yeah, see if there's anything that the talk perhaps elicited in you, confusions, difficulty, or things which are like, oh, that's an interesting way to look at, or places of confusion. I'm sure I was not completely clear for all of the talk.
I have a clarifying question.
Yes, go ahead.
I'm imagining in this practice that it might take some time to realize that there was birth happening, that there was selfing going on. And I'm wondering if it needs to happen in the moment, or is it useful maybe to bring into your sitting meditation, like remembering a moment when you were feeling a charged feeling, and then reflecting on it, or just wondering about the timing. Because I know sometimes when I'm flooded with emotion, it's very hard to access that awareness. And or is it kind of calling a timeout and sitting and getting still with your body? Or like, what does it actually look like to have this awareness? Because I know when I'm very emotional, it's hard to, that's when it's hardest for me to practice. And I imagine I'm not alone with that.
Yeah, exactly. The short answer is, yeah, both are very helpful. And the reality of it is, it's in the midst of a really reactive mind state, it is hard to have that bit of spaciousness, because we are so enmeshed in it. It's like we are really, we're really reacting from our emotions and just triggering us again and again. And so there's no sense of space that we can find. We can't even find our feet in the midst of that. And so in those cases, you know, it's really helpful to take that, especially something that's really activated, and plop it down in the middle of your meditation. So, you know, a good technique I learned from Ajahn Amaro, you know, years ago when he visited Sims for non-residential, was to do a little sandwich technique. So what you do is you take the first third of the meditation and you just focus on connecting with the body, fully arriving, you know, feeling, you know, something that's really allows you to fully show up. And the middle third, just plop that situation right in the middle of it. So what I mean by that is you kind of almost invite it in. So you might use your mind to think about it, to recall it enough to kind of get the juices churning, if you will. You know, and if it's really charged, it won't take much, right? Mm-hmm. To bring it forth. And then the trick then in that middle third is, how do you still stay grounded while you're relating and seeing this state of mind? So the first third of meditation gives you that bit of stability to be able to meet that, to actually observe it more clearly. Okay, and then once you can observe it, and you can, first thing is you just stick with observing, try to meet it as clearly as you can. Say, okay, what's the sensations in the body? You know, where is this located? What's the subtle beliefs? You know, what's the concepts? What am I believing in? And so, and all that, once you start to flush that out a bit, you can start to step back and say, okay, and where's the sense of me who's showing up? You know, and often you feel that, this is something I didn't touch on, but there's a little bit of a sense of the ground getting a little loose under your feet. Because the sense of identity, part of the hunger is it creates this sense of stability, this sense of I know who I am. Because we really know who we are when we're angry, when we're upset. It's really clear, right? And you start to see that is just another mind state. It's no different than the thought, like, what am I going to have for lunch? Ultimately, other than all the rehearsing and all the believing in that, it starts to fall away, and the ground that you took thought is so solid starts to fade a little bit. And so like, whoa, and that's actually a good sign, a little bit of, oh, I took that as being so solid, and it's not. And then with the last third of the practice of this kind of way of practicing, you go back to just feeling the body to help kind of cool the system back down, find a place of orientation. And if your mind starts to get really churning, you might go back to the body focus, and depending on how hot or intense the situation is. So, and you can do this in a sitting practice. You could do it walking. I mean, that's much of the time I do it these days, is I might feel reactive and I take a walk in the woods nearby my house. And I just kind of let myself fully feel it. I just open to this whole experience of the hurt, you know, the outrage, the sense of being, you know, overlooked, whatever it might be, and all the archaic pieces. But it's being held, this is an important part, held in a wider context than just the narrowness of self and of me. When we're really reactive, there's just this blinders on it, just me and this thing. But when we're able to have a spaciousness, I'm almost holding equal awareness. Let's say my left hand is the reactivity, the pain. I'm equally holding my right hand, which might be the sensation of my feet touching the ground, the sense of the breeze touching my face. That's held in an equal sense of balance. When this becomes prominent and I start to become sucked into it, my attention starts to get lost in it, and I lose that perspective, the relative reality kind of takes form, takes hold of me. So another time it's good to kind of set that aside, go back to that spaciousness. So in this way, you start to get a sense of, when can I meet the difficulty with this balanced attention? When I don't have that balanced attention, then it's almost kind of re-churning and reactivating. Once you do this, can I get a sense of this? It's like once you get that taste of the emptiness, the sense of spaciousness around that, when you start to loosen that, you're able to do it more on the fly, more in the midst of the argument, more in the midst of trying to parent a child who's being really obnoxious or whatever it might be.
How did you know? That's what I was thinking of.
just intuited it there.
Yeah.
And as a parent, I mean, that's such a helpful way to bring that little bit of a pause in, because often we don't have to act as quickly as we do as a parent. We can step back and just take a couple breaths and notice, okay, what am I adding? What am I bringing to this? Mm-hmm. And when you start to get that sense of, like, especially patterns of control, of wanting to do what you think is right. And it's a little shocking and shameful to see all that. But if you can see without judgment, it starts to allow you to be much more balanced with your child, and, you know, listen to the feedback that they are giving you. Which, if your child's like my child, you're getting constant feedback about, you know, how. And sometimes, you have to say things which, you know, they don't like. Like, no, you do have to go to bed, or, you know, 10 pieces of Halloween candy are enough. You know, whatever structure you might have to do.
That's helpful. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. So be patient with it. Be curious with it. And again, once you start to get some taste of it, you can start to be, that becomes an orienting factor. You can start to sense that in other times. Mm-hmm. But yeah, definitely we can bring it into the daily life, in the midst of life. That's when you really start to learn. All right. Thank you, Allie.
Thank you.
All right, what else is out there?
Hey, Tim.
Hi, sounds like Peter.
Yeah. Hi there. I can
find your face here. Go ahead, Peter. What's your question or comment?
There you are. Yeah, I just, I had a a similar experience to your example about kind of going outside, you know, into another physical space that was more expansive, and maybe this is partly just noticing, like right now, like, you know, I'm like inside, I'm working in my house all day, and I've been doing a lot of calls for the election to voters, and I'm interacting with, you know, far, far, far fewer people in person, mainly my spouse. And it's like everything just starts to just, it kind of build in like a pressure cooker in there. Mm. And there was one evening where, you know, I said some things on a call for work that weren't, you know, or I made a mistake and that was bothering me, you know, talking to a client, and I realized I, you know, said something incorrect and needed to, you know, felt bad about that. And then I did a bunch of calls and then I had a discussion with my wife where I was getting real irritated, and, you know, and it is just, and I took this walk outside. This was like last Thursday, and there was a full moon or nearly a full moon. And it was absolutely, you know, clear and still. And it was like, it just all just immediately just dropped away. Hmm. And it was so powerful. Just how you could, it was just like it just immediately almost drained away, just stepping out of the house. Yeah. It was like I just walked out of the pot that was boiling, you know? Hmm. And it was, yeah, it was like this immediate relief. It was such an amazing change. And so I don't know if there's anything you want to comment about that, but it surprised me how helpful it was.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that, Peter. It's a really good thing to add to this discussion, is that, you know, especially in this COVID world, and we, you know, we're stuck online, we're stuck in a much smaller container than we're used to. You know, if we're trying to raise our children, we're having to work and then maybe also be a homeschooler and all this, we have no time to ourselves. And so sometimes stepping back, and it's hard when in the midst of it, because we don't realize how much we need that space. But now you realize, okay, going outdoors into the beauty of an evening reestablishes that space. So we start to develop that almost intuitive sense of, how do I care for my mind? How do I care for my body? And, you know, unfortunately, sometimes when we most need it, we have the hardest time accessing that wisdom. And so, you know, realizing that, you know, maybe building the routines into your life that, you know, each day I will get outside, each day I will move, do something that helps me nourish myself, that help me reestablish that sense of balance, that sense of spaciousness, you know, however that might look. You know, some of us, the circumstances are very challenging, like we just don't seem like we have any space. So you be as creative as you can, you know, whatever it might be, just give that little bit of space as much as you can, and building it into our day, because we will forget, you know, get caught up in the busyness of life and the urgency of life, because that's what life does. So having that bit of a practice is it's like a little ritual to return, you know, back to your centeredness.
Yeah.
Thank you, Peter.
Definitely. Yeah, you're welcome.
I think that's very helpful for us all to hear. And I often feel that sense of, like, I'm cooking too much. Like if I'm teaching a retreat, you know, and there's a lot of intensity with the interviews, just getting out and getting away from the retreat center, going for a walk is off the grounds. It can really help reset everything in a profound way. So I think each of us know, you know, what resets us. You know, it might look differently. It might be playing music. It might be having a conversation with someone that you really brings you joy. It might be reading a book, it might be taking a walk, it might be exercising. But Dharma practice is also about learning that sense of self-care, you know, and really having that sense of reverence for, how do I care for the body? How do I care for this mind? And it's so important in these days. Thank you, Peter. Anyone else? All right, looks like I have a question in the chat. Do meditation instructions like following the breath happen from the relative or absolute perspective? is the absolute perspective more mindful. All right, so that's it's a great question. And so the instructions usually start in the relative, because that's where we connect with students. That's how we connect with ourselves, because we're operating in this relative world. So instructions have to have some way of making contact with that. But the instructions, if they're coming from a wisdom place, but if their underlying perspective is liberation, that's the purpose for practice, there's often embedded in them the absolute. Something as simple as notice your breath without judgment, without resistance. Okay, so that makes sense from the relative world. Okay, I'm not supposed to judge my breath. I just let it be like it is. But if I start to take that deeper into the an absolute perspective, when I really deeply, deeply resist or let go of the resistance, let go of the judgment, the sense of self is not operating. It falls away and the absolute arises. So often instructions, when they're done well, have this interesting quality of embedding the absolute, even in a relatively phrased instructions. That's why the instructions can work for someone who's brand new and someone who's been practicing for many years. And is the absolute perspective more mindful? So, again, the absolute, another way of saying this is whenever you are aware of you being the meditator, there's that identity of me meditating, of me learning to relate to my body or my mind, my emotions more skillfully in a meditative way. That's a relative reality. It's a skillful relative reality. When that sense of you who is meditating starts to fall away, when the meditation starts to meditate, the meditation is just doing itself, when there's a sense of deep stillness that's indistinguishable from the sense of you, when things arise, thoughts, emotions, sensations, sounds are all held in this field of awareness, not referencing back to you, then the absolute is what's meditating. And so our practice, we learn to navigate back and forth between these. Sometimes the relative reality, we need to really pay attention to that. The relative reality of being overwhelmed by, being on a computer all day, having the lack of interaction with others, or having the demands of having, children that are stir crazy, whatever it might be. There's that relative reality that we have to attend to, and to meet it in a mindful way is so helpful. And we also have that ear toward, okay, what's the release of that? What can hold us that doesn't matter whether my child is screaming or peaceful? There is this quality of the absolute. And this is, it is something that has to reveal itself. It's one of those mysteries of our practice. And it is what our practice is designed to uncover. So hopefully that helps. I don't know if that was Khaled or Valerie. Okay, you're welcome. All right, so thank you for your attention. We just have a few announcements here before we finish the evening. Before Cheryl speaks, I'd like to just say a few words about Donna, if that's all right. So Donna, as you all know, is the Pali word for generosity. And this is this tradition, this really wonderful tradition that's been going on for 2,600 years, that the teachings are offered in a freely offered way, that we don't have a set price or a set fee for those. And that way people can come regardless of having to worry about means. And the way it's worked for all these many years, since the time of the Buddha, is that people gave to support the teachings, gave to support the individual, the monk, the nun, the teacher, the organization. And some people gave a little bit, some came a lot, depending on what their means were. And that was all completely fine, and it all balanced out and allowed the tradition to continue through hard times and through difficult times and abundant times to this day. And right now we are in a bit of a difficult time, that I think something about the virtual world, that sometimes it's easy to feel a little disconnected from the concept of Dana. like we go on YouTube and watch videos and it just seemed like it's all free. And we come here and we don't see the other people offering Dana in the same way. And so, you know, myself and Sims and I think every teacher I've talked to have noticed that Dana donations have really dropped quite a bit these during the COVID times. So sometimes we might feel just giving a little bit, it's not worth giving it. But if you take whatever you might give and multiply it by 100 people, that adds up. So I encourage you to give, you know, have that relationship to supporting Sims, you know, Seattle Insight, as well as whoever might be teaching. As many teachers, you know, much of their livelihood comes from retreats, and those retreats have been canceled or gone online and have the same issues. So, you know, it's just to bring that sense of awareness that the Dharma needs your participation. The most important participation is your sincerity of practice. And we also need this participation that helps keep the organization healthy, that keeps the teachers being able to continue to teach. So I'll put those Dana information back on the thing. The website has the donate tab that has information there for Sims and for the teachers. And I'll put that back in the chat. So thank you for your generosity. And as we come near the end of the year, considering end of the year gifts and ongoing contributions. All right. Thank you.